Well, this is a great privilege to come to Ohio State University since I did my PhD work at the University of Southern California. I date myself by telling you there was a time when USC and OSU could pretty much count on meeting each other in the Rose Bowl. But time moves on. We all do. After I did my work in philosophy, particularly the theory of knowledge at the University of Southern California, I went on to teach seminary courses in apologetics and to do some writing and eventually pastored a church for a number of years, but because of the many requests for writing and debating and so forth that I was involved in, the church eventually began a ministry that turned into the Southern California Center for Christian Studies, which I now work full-time for. A good portion of this time is spent going around speaking to groups such as your own. And one of the things that's really on my heart as a believer is to encourage Christians to defend the Christian faith. When you're at a secular campus, obviously this is of relevance. And when the opportunity came to speak for your society, I was sent some questions, as we've already joked about, eight of them. Six were named, and there were eight questions actually there on the sheet that you were hoping I might address in the short time that we have over lunch. And I'm going to get to your questions in just a moment, but I'd like to open with some programmatic remarks about defending the faith, especially defending the faith in the situation that you find yourself in, which is, at least at this point in the development of God's kingdom, not real favorable, I'm sure. You don't find yourself in the majority often. And as you know, it's not politically correct to hold to Christian convictions, and many of the conservative, orthodox, or historic convictions of the Christian faith are even being given up by mainline denominations many times. And so if you hold to any kind of biblical conviction about the Lord Jesus Christ and the truth of his word, you find yourself kind of in a little corner sometimes, and you wonder, well, now what can I say when people, you know, either find this quaint, or what can I say when they find it downright wrong? What kind of answers can I offer to them for my faith? In his second epistle to the pastor Timothy, the Apostle Paul, in chapter 2 of that epistle, writes these words, "But foolish and ignorant questions refuse, knowing that they engender strife. And the Lord's servant must not strive, but be gentle toward all, apt to teach, forbearing, in gentleness correcting those that oppose themselves, if peradventure God may give them repentance unto the knowledge of the truth, and they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him unto his will." We don't have time to look at that entire passage, but I find it fascinating that on the first opening line, Paul tells us we're to refuse questions that are characteristic of fools. Paul says, don't be sucked into the fool's game. I'll bet that many of you have had situations arise in your own lives where you know that the person who is asking you questions or is needling you or challenging you is not really looking for the truth. They're looking for one-upmanship on you socially. This happens sometimes when you go to family dinners, right? Thanksgiving in many households is a pretty tense time for a lot of reasons. But if you're an evangelical Christian, if you're a Bible-believing Christian, it can especially be tough as that obstinate brother-in-law has the needling question. You know, well, what about this and what about that? Well, the Bible tells us what to do in situations like that, and the answer there is don't say anything. Refuse those kind of questions. Just do not get involved in something of that nature, because it's not going to go anywhere healthy. In fact, one of the things you can do to have a testimony for the Lord Jesus Christ is to show his own character in circumstances like that, because the Lord's servant doesn't strive, but is gentle towards all. And the Proverbs taught us, long before Jesus illustrated this in his own life, that it's the gentle answer that turns away the angry tongue. And so we need to learn, first of all, to control ourselves and to know when to speak and how to speak, with what spirit. And sometimes, believe it or not, how can a person be in a ministry of apologetics? And I start by sometimes the answer is to give no answer. Sometimes the answer is to show that you can take the ridicule and not feel so belittled or put down or so threatened that you have to have something to say, you know, to return one smart-alecky remark with another smart-alecky remark and show we're the best of the smart-alecky. Well, we aren't. We're the Lord's servants. And that means gentleness and the fruit of the Spirit must characterize us. And yet, Paul does not mean that we keep perpetually silent, even in the face of the fool's questions. Because you'll notice he goes on to say that we're to be apt to teach in gentleness, correcting those that oppose themselves, if peradventure God may grant them repentance unto a knowledge of the truth. And so sometimes the best thing to do when you have a hostile colleague in your department or someone you're eating lunch with and just can't imagine that you could be a Christian in the late 20th century, sometimes it's to simply let them ridicule and not to answer, not to meet them on that turf. But the time is going to come when you may gently, Paul says, correct them. But now listen to how Paul tells us to correct those who are ridiculing the faith. He says, correcting them who oppose themselves, if peradventure God may grant them repentance. Now that little expression is crucial to understanding how to effectively defend the Christian faith. Because Paul says those who have raised the smart-alecky questions, who think they know so much, who want to put down the quaintness or the superstitious character of your faith, are in fact opposing themselves. And I'm going to talk to you about that for a few moments, and then I'm going to take the 6, 7, 8 questions that were sent to me and try to use them as illustrations of how you can answer the foolish questions of those who are unbelieving about you, even in an academic environment. Now, I have to boil this down. In fact, I'm forced to do that because I speak so often, boiling things down, and my ideal is someday to get to the place where I am so adept at this that I can stand before an audience and simply wink and everybody will go, we get it. Then we can be a lunch speaker and get everything in, right? Well, I haven't gotten it down that far, but I do have a few things that I can give you in the short time that we have that I hope will lead you in further reflection to be more effective in defending the faith. As you know, my own particular academic expertise is in epistemology, theory of knowledge. And if I could share anything from what I've learned there with you that would be helpful to you as believers in defending the faith, it would be this. Do not look upon people's beliefs as marbles, but as webs. Not marbles, but webs. Now, what do I mean by that? The biggest mistake Christians make of a programmatic nature in defending the faith is they think of Christianity as just one more marble in the jar of all their beliefs. And so if I were to take that marble out, all the other marbles would be there and unaffected, right? Most people know that. If you had a fishbowl full of marbles, and one particular red marble stands for your Christian faith, you could take that red marble out. There might be a little bit of adjustment in the marbles around it, but then everything would be settled down, and life would just go right on. And that is completely inaccurate. That's inaccurate whether we're talking about Christian conviction or any conviction. You probably have a belief right now, in fact you will have one once I finish the question because you can't avoid it, about whether it is snowing outside or not. And you might think, well, that's just like a marble, right? It could be snowing outside, it could not be snowing outside. That's true, but your belief that it's snowing outside is connected to other beliefs you have. For one, for those of you who looked over toward the window when I said that, beliefs about the reliability of your sense perception. And where that figures into how we come to our convictions and how we respond to them. Everyone's beliefs are webbed, if you will. They're networked together in various ways. And there are various ways in which some beliefs support other beliefs or are irrelevant to other beliefs. But all of them form a web of some sort. They are not marbles in a jar. Now, just knowing that tells you something about how you should defend the faith when you have faculty members that ask you questions with the idea that how could you possibly believe this. In the first place, don't ever feel intimidated as though you have to defend that one belief that's at stake right now in the conversation. Realize that your belief that that is true is tied to other beliefs, and your colleague's belief that it's not true is tied to other beliefs as well. And what you want to do is start testing the webs. This is just a colorful or graphic way of talking about doing worldview apologetics. Now, if someone comes to me, I have a number of students on campuses and people who write to me and so forth, they ask particular questions. And I don't always get into philosophical issues when I, you know, defend the faith. Sometimes I just give them a direct answer and I want to see where will that go. But almost always, and I'll bet this has been your experience too, almost always when someone has a particular question about Christianity, if you had an answer for that, that wouldn't settle things. And that's because people are, well, the Bible tells us this, they're playing games. You know, they're finding ways of avoiding God. You know, what W.C. Fields said when he was on his deathbed in the hospital, a nurse came in, found him reading the Bible, which was pretty shocking given his lifestyle. She said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Searching for loopholes." Well, that may be a mildly funny joke, but it's deathly serious in the lives of the people with whom you speak. Because they want to talk about religion only in the same way that the woman at the well wanted to talk about religion, looking for loopholes. You remember what the woman at the well did? Jesus asked her a question, and that led to another question, and pretty soon she's embarrassed about her lifestyle, and then she wants to talk theology. She goes, "Oh, well, you know, you Jews say this, and we Samaritans say this, and what's your opinion?" Well, that's one of the oldest tricks in the book, you know. Get a religious person to talk about religion rather than your personal standing before God. And your colleagues, when they ridicule you, when they bring up these questions, you need to know, first of all, that what they're saying is tied to other beliefs they have, and they are not bringing it up because if you could just answer that one question, they'd now bow the knee and confess Jesus as Lord. Isn't going to happen that way. I won't say in the history of mankind it has never happened, but it's so statistically marginal that it's not worth talking about. When people raise problems with Christianity, they've got a worldview, they've got a net of beliefs, just like you have a net, or if you will, a web of beliefs, and you need to start exploring that web, pushing a bit. And it turns out, especially in an academic environment such as a secular university, the crisis of postmodernism is a great aid to apologetics. You say, how can that be? I thought the crisis of postmodernism is one of the things we should be concerned with. And I am. But you see, the postmodernists at least have this going for them. If you let them talk long enough, they get it all spilled out there. They have their guts out on the table, and you say, well, there you have it. Now you've got a choice. Because the postmodernists are honest enough to not try to hold on to values, not try to hold on to any kind of even common communication ability given the intellectual structure, or is there any structure of the human mind to begin with? Most unbelievers find themselves in the uncomfortable position of when they do academic work, they're assuming things which only the Christian worldview can make sense out of, and then they turn around and they shoot their arrows at particular Christian beliefs. And if you will back them up and ask questions like, well, now why do you believe that, and on what basis do you believe that? It will turn out that they've got their own commitments as well. But their commitments are without any kind of academic credibility. They're just arbitrarily assuming things which they have no right to. Give you a real easy illustration. Okay? Let's say you're working in one of the laboratory sciences and you find out that one of your colleagues is not a Christian. He makes fun of your Christian faith and so forth. You can ask him about such things as, do we need to be honest in reporting our lab report? Do we have to tell the truth what we find? I mean, everybody takes that for granted at the university, right? Of course you have to tell the truth. Well, let's ask why. Why do you have to tell the truth? What obligation is there to tell the truth? Now, what if it turns out that by fudging on the lab reports, we can get a grant that will fund the department for 3 more years, and another project within the department is going to do great you know, good for the human race. Now, what's your colleague going to say about this? Well, he might say, yeah, that's fine. But if he does, then you want to buy another cup of coffee tomorrow and say, I'd like to go a little bit further in what you've taught me. You know, and just keep driving back until it turns out, you see, there could be no science without moral foundations. Most people don't think of science as the realm of ethics, and it's not, because that's not the front runner of what scientists talk about when they give their lectures and write their reports and so forth. But you can't be a scientist without some kind of moral conviction about truth and error, and that we're under moral obligation to tell the truth. But now, what worldview supports that? Postmodernism doesn't support that. Behaviorism doesn't support that. Materialism doesn't support that. Well, you keep looking at it. Eventually, if your colleague doesn't just go to the heart of the matter and want to talk about Christianity, eventually you're going to be reduced to talking about philosophical and particularly religious points of view. And so, rather than answering the fool's ridicule up front, Paul advises us sometimes that we should be gentle, patient, apt to teach, and in gentleness correcting those who oppose themselves. We want to point out to people that if their web of beliefs is not Christian in character, in the end they are opposing themselves as they try to maintain, especially in the modern university, rationality, objectivity, the dignity of man, love, purpose in human life, moral absolutes. Now, we could talk about others, but you know my time is short. That short list, that right there is enough to cover every department. Every department, in one way or another, is going to want to talk about objectivity, rationality, love, purpose, moral absolutes, what have you. And so my advice to you of a programmatic nature is think in terms of general worldviews, not just one-on-one issues, not just the marbles, but think about the web of beliefs that people have. And then correct the foolish question by asking, how do you know, why do you do what you do, and how, given your professed worldview, could you maintain rationality? You say, well, what's so hard about rationality? Well, in the first place, there's a crisis in modern philosophy, psychology, what have you, as to what rationality amounts to. And let's take one of the low level, I think this is a really boring view of it, but let's just say rationality is the ability to order things so that you can accomplish the goal you want. So that if you want C, you know that you have to do A and then B and then you can get C. And that if you're able to do that, then you're a rational person. Okay? Well, now, I'm not so sure that you are a rational person just because you can order things in that way. I mean, after all, there are certain terrible things that might be the C, which is your goal. And if people are able to accomplish that effectively, we might not call them rational. We might call them, in fact, brutal. But let's accept it. You know, over coffee, you can discuss a lot of things. You don't have to get everything settled at once. Let's just accept that. What kind of world would we have to live in order for people to order their decisions so that A will lead to B and B will lead to C? Well, it'd have to be a world, first of all, where you can perceive A, B, and C, and you can predict what's going to happen when you pursue them. Isn't that right? What kind of world allows for predictability? Well, a world that doesn't allow for predictability is one that says everything's matter and motion. Because if everything's matter and motion, there's nothing either in matter or in motion itself to tell us that the way things move or the way things they are constituted today is the way they will move and be constituted tomorrow. David Hume, of course, is the one who classically, you know, wrote the problem of induction up, but every scientist and every rational person who wants to get from A to B to C has got to believe that there's predictability and therefore some kind of uniformity in this world. But if you believe there's nothing more but matter and motion, then you have no basis for predictability. Actually, you don't have any basis for beliefs either. You stop and think about it. Because matter doesn't have beliefs. Neither does motion. And if you put matter in motion, you still don't have beliefs. In the nature of the case, beliefs have a certain structure having to do with intentionality, perception, self-conception. That is to say, there's a certain view of man that you're dealing with when you talk about people having beliefs. Bricks don't have beliefs. and either do computers. Although you can talk about computers in a personified way, just like you can talk about your pet dog in a personified way, but the fact is nothing that we call beliefs is appropriate to bricks or computers. So now, if you have a person who is going to be rational, just getting from A to B to C, they already have to have some view of human nature and some view of the world in which we live, neither of which can be justified, it will turn out, apart from that web of beliefs that we call Christianity. All right, so my programmatic suggestion to you is to think in terms of worldviews and in terms of reducing the unbeliever's worldview to absurdity on the very issues that are crucial to university life, be it rationality, scientific inference, objectivity, the ability to communicate in language, the dignity of man, love, purpose, moral absolutes. Three things that you want to look for when you talk to your colleagues who are unbelievers. First of all, arbitrariness. Secondly, inconsistency. And thirdly, what I'm going to call now the preconditions of intelligibility. That's like winking at you. If I give you that expression, I am summarizing what I've been trying to tell you up to this point. What are the preconditions for the intelligibility of rational work, scientific work, any kind of work having to do with value, human purpose, freedom, what have you? And the answer to the question, going to the back of the book here, is that only the Christian worldview can provide those preconditions that will make university life and work intelligible in the first place. But you need also to be looking for inconsistencies in the unbeliever's worldview. Okay, back in the days when I was in college and graduate school and so forth, there was something called the Vietnam War going on. You probably have heard of it. And it was amazing to talk to graduate students who would say things like, they found the Vietnam War utterly immoral. The United States government was completely immoral to be involved in this. And leave to the side whether that's right or wrong. But add to this now the same person saying, but it's up to me to decide whether I live with my girlfriend out of wedlock. When it comes to sex, it's different strokes for different folks. But when it comes to war, there's this moral absolute that governments can be condemned for not towing the line to. Well, now, what I want to know is how do you put these two together? How do you put together a worldview that says I can condemn war absolutely, but I can live with my girlfriend if I wish to, because everybody decides their own morality? Well, the comeback to that is, well, then Richard Nixon can decide his own morality, right? Why couldn't he do whatever he wanted to do in terms of bombing? By the way, why couldn't he lie to the American public? Isn't it incredible that unbelievers become so righteously indignant over things, having just told us everything's up for grabs in ethics? Well, you can't have it both ways. So you have to look for inconsistencies in the web of belief. You have to ask about the preconditions of intelligibility. And then finally, you shouldn't even have to say this in a university setting, but we do. It's a postmodern world, after all. People don't have the right to be arbitrary, just to believe willy-nilly whatever they want. Somehow, that has become the zeitgeist of our culture. That's the spirit of our day, that I have the right to believe what I want. It's what I call epistemological democracy. You know? When it comes to what I will believe, when it comes to what I consider truth, I have the right to believe anything I want. I usually say when people tell me that, you do have the right to believe anything you want. You don't have the right to be right. There's a big difference between those two, isn't there? You know, what if I were to come, let's kind of back up to the beginning of our little lunchtime chat, and I would have begun by saying, I've come up with a fabulous proof of relativism. I said, really? I said, yeah. I've taught math to sixth graders for 10 years, and I've made copies of all the math homework that's come in. I've logged this, I've looked it over and so forth, and I'm absolutely convinced that there is no truth in mathematics. You say, why? I said, well, because when they gave their answers back to me, they differed from one another. Now, who am I to say you're right and you're wrong? That would be a terrible self-righteous thing to do. I'm convinced that, in fact, when it comes to mathematics, everybody creates their own reality. Now, you probably, if you didn't get up and go to another room and say, let's find somebody decent to listen to, you probably said, well, that's just absurd. Because you haven't shown us that truth in mathematics is relative. You've just shown us that beliefs in mathematics are relative. Johnny believes this is the answer to number six. Susie believes that that's the answer. But they can't both be right. Well, okay, so you'd get A's in philosophy. You're doing well. That's right. You've drawn a good distinction. Why, then, doesn't our culture draw that distinction when we talk about morality and we talk about religion? We somehow bought into the idea when it comes to those things, because apparently you can't touch them or taste them, that everyone has the right to believe whatever they want, and they have the right to be right about what they're believing. See, I don't want to go to anybody and say, now listen, you've got to stop believing what you do, and I'm going to force you to believe the way I do. Yeah, you have a right to believe different from me, but you are not going to be in touch with reality just because you think you're in touch with reality. And so we have to look for arbitrariness in people's beliefs, we have to look for inconsistency in people's beliefs, and finally we have to ask, what are the preconditions of intelligibility? That expression doesn't scare any of you now. Preconditions of intelligibility are, what would the world have to be like for there to be rationality, for there to be science, for there to be moral absolutes, objectivity, language, dignity for man, love, or purpose? This is what we call worldview apologetics. And I didn't come here to give an advertisement for our study center, believe me, but if you would like more on this that I can't give right now, we do have catalogs and I think some contact cards. If you'd like to get on our mailing list, then we can give you a lot of material, some of which has to do with my debates at universities with atheists and so forth. You might see how this comes into play. And I'm able to give you one illustration. Most recently, I debated an atheist at the University of California on the Davis campus, a fellow who had been there, had some reputation for obliterating Christians. And this Christian club got in touch with me and said, we really need you to come in here. I said, that's great. This guy's obliterated all these Christians. I want me to come in. They're like Daniel in the lion's den. But anyway, I knew something of what he was excited about and what he was angry about. He had relatives who had died at Auschwitz. And was very sarcastic about the living God, saying that maybe God was asleep at the wheel of the universe when his relatives had been gassed by Hitler and things of that nature. In his opening presentation in the debate, he railed against God, said all sorts of sarcastic things, and particularly was upset that people would be sent to hell for not praying correctly, as he put it. All right, so he talked about the religious wars of the Old Testament, a number of other things, but hell was really something that bothered him, on and on. Well, when I stood up to reply to what he had said, I said, basically all my opponent has told me tonight is that he doesn't like the Christian God. But I'm having a hard time seeing what the philosophical significance of that is. If he doesn't like the Christian God, are we supposed to believe now that we can take the next step and say the Christian God doesn't exist? That kind of like somebody saying, I don't like broccoli, so I pull the covers over my head and the broccoli's not there. You see, you have to look at the way in which a person is reasoning. Put his attacks, his challenges, even his ridicule in that web of beliefs and say, now, are you telling me that because you don't like something that you can then conclude it doesn't exist, it has no reality? Because all you've said so far tonight is, I don't like God. I'll buy that. But I think he exists too. And I know this isn't very polite to say in some company, but you know, God doesn't like you too much either. And you might want to get right with him rather than him worrying about getting right with you. Because if he exists, you can be very sure that's going to be the order of importance. It's not going to be God saying, oh, what can I possibly do to make you happy with me? You're going to say, what could you possibly do that I would ever be happy with you? And that's where Jesus comes in. Okay, well, you know the rest of that story. Let me cut now to your eight questions. I've lost my watcher. How much time do I have, Hart?
Oh, we're cranking on about 15, 18, 20.
Okay, 2 minutes each. Just about right, okay. And I'm just going to read the question the way it came to me, and I'm going to try to give you a little soundbite answer to each one. And then if we have any time at the end, or if you want to stay afterwards, if you don't have to get on, I'd be glad to answer questions that you might have. One question read, at the cutting edge of quantum physics these days is a tendency toward a Zen-like philosophy. A wholly quantum universe could be completely chaotic and ordered according to multiple frames of reference, each of which could be completely correct while operating on the principles of that frame of reference. Even Einstein admitted that the objective universe could contain multiple possibilities. If our consciousness is capable of ordering the universe, how can it be known that the Christian faith is not simply one explanation among many to explain the universe? And this really could, I mean, I could go a lot of directions with this and keep us here another 30, 40 minutes just on it. But let me tell you, first of all, this is one of the oldest tricks in debate. Now, not that the person who did this was doing it on purpose, mind you. But you see, if I can get my opponent to accept a contradiction, I've got him. Because from a contradiction, you can deduce anything. If we had a blackboard and you had a few extra minutes, I could show you that. Any logician will tell you that. From P and not P, I can prove anything. Anything. Just throw it in there and I'll show you how it's done by the rules of logic. Well, in this question, there is a contradiction contained. It's not malicious, it's not intentional, but it's massive. I want to read a sentence here that brings it out. A wholly quantum universe could be completely chaotic and ordered according to multiple frames of reference. So I just circled that. Chaotic and ordered? You could have a view of the world that is chaotic and ordered? Now, usually the way people would deal with that is to say, well, there's some chaos and there's some order. And then the big question is, well, why are some things ordered and some things chaotic? I mean, that's what Plato could never get, you know, taken care of in his philosophy. But here the question is, on this Zen or quantum approach, it's completely chaotic. Well, if it's completely chaotic, then it can't be ordered, can it? Because those are contradictory attributes. Now, what people will say is, oh, well, what we mean is, it's chaotic out there, ordered in here, wherever it is, okay? Well, there's a problem, isn't there? Why is it that what's characteristic of what's out there not characteristic of what's in here? Are there two realities? Or is this one principle that says everything is chaos not really apply to everything? In which case, it's not a universal principle, and I don't have to be all that respectful of it. If it is a universal principle, then my thinking is chaotic as well. How is it that my thinking, which is chaotic, just like everything in the universe, can become ordered? And then here's an even tougher one. How is it that my thinking, which is chaotic but somehow becomes ordered, can now make that which is chaotic out there ordered? You see, this is, the question itself won't fly. It's got P and not P in there, and I don't know how anybody's going to bring them together. And yet, I don't know who gave the question if you're here today. I don't mean to be disrespectful to you, because this is really popular stuff. You read this, and, I mean, undergraduates, they ooh and aah. They say, oh, yeah, well, that's deep. It's silly is what it is, but it's deep. Number two, the Veritas Forum seems to assert that moral and religious truth is the same as scientific or empirical truth. This is a very tenuous equation which needs justification. Please explain how moral and religious truth differs from beliefs and how it can be categorized as truth in a factual sense. Now, this question, too, has some confusions in it. It's a shame you had to come out to hear an epistemologist respond to these sorts of things. But you see, belief and truth are different questions. They're different issues. They're different concepts altogether. And so when someone, I don't know if the Veritas Forum does this or not, but when they assert that moral and religious truth is the same as scientific or empirical truth, if they mean when we use truth claims here, we mean by truth the same sort of thing as when we make truth claims there, they have to be absolutely right or else we're equivocating. Truth is truth is truth. That's all there is to it. Now the word can be used in different ways and can certainly be used in different ways in different settings with respect to different departments or aspects of reality, no doubt about that. And you can ask, how do we know the truth? How do we justify beliefs about morality over against how do we justify truths about what causes cancer. You know, those may be different methodologies, to be sure. But when you make a truth claim, you're saying the same thing about truth in all the cases in which you make the claim. There is a difference between truth and belief. There's a difference between knowledge and truth and belief. When someone believes something which is true, they still don't have knowledge of it. For you see, I may believe that it's snowing outside and not have any evidence for it. I just made a lucky guess. If you say that you know that it's snowing outside, is it? I don't know. It's because you have some kind of what? Experience, some kind of rational foundation. And it's not always of the look and see sort, but the point is knowledge requires proof or justification. Okay, so I would say that religious truth as truth is just as true as scientific truth as truth. But I would grant that the way in which we make scientific decisions is not always the way in which we make religious decisions. Now that would be the real polite way to, but I'm going to now open another aggravation. And I would add this, and that the way in which scientists make decisions about the truth would not be available to them if what we as Christians said as true were not true. If a sovereign God who created this world and providentially controls it did not exist, there'd be no rational foundation for scientific induction or inference. We've already heard about that. Number three, Christianity doesn't have a monopoly on truth. Since all faiths contain elements of truth, how can you assert that Christianity is the only way? And if you make this assertion, what's to prevent intolerance of other faiths in a multicultural society? Well, this is a layered question. The first thing that is asserted here is that all faiths contain elements of truth. Actually, that's not the case. But I know that we're not going to get very far if I have to tell you about comparative religion and so forth. If you mean by that all faiths say things like, when you cut a finger, it bleeds, okay, all faiths have elements of truth there. But if you mean the distinctive claims of all religions somewhere contain some truth, that's just not correct. And whoever said this has not studied comparative religion. I'll give you some doozies. And I don't know anything distinctive to those faiths, which is true. But where there are distinctives which are true, we have to ask ourselves, are they really distinctives? Let's leave Christianity out of the picture just for a second so you can see the anatomy of the problem. What if you have a Muslim who makes claim P, and you have a Hindu that makes claim not P? Now, P and not P are distinctive beliefs, right? Because they contradict each other. Can both be true? Well, it all depends on whether you're a Muslim or a Hindu. The Muslim would say, no, they can't both be true, because the Muslim's committed to rationality. The Hindu would say, yeah, it's a very strange universe we live in. Right? I've gotten into any number of discussions with Hare Krishnas and other versions of Hinduism and so forth, and whenever I finally reduce them to a contradiction, and it's not hard to do, you know what they say? Who cares about contradictions? I say, well, if you don't care about contradictions, why are you talking to me? They say, well, we don't care about contradictions. I say, well, then you do. They say, no, are you listening? We don't care about contradictions. And I say, if you don't care about contradictions, then I can contradict you. Then you do care about contradictions. You see, to have that worldview, you'd have to give up talking. And you'd have to give up thinking. And I don't think, you know, given what I believe as a Christian, that's really possible. But that's what people would have to start doing. But the point is, the distinctive beliefs of the different religions can't all be true if you're going to save rationality. And now the next layer is to tell you, I'm not the one going around saying Christianity's got all the truth and nobody else knows anything. I'm just the messenger here. That's what Jesus said. You know? He said, there isn't any other way to the Father but by me. And you have the right to say I don't agree with him. Your not agreeing with him is not going to make it any better for you on the day of judgment if what he says is true, however. And so people ought to stop worrying about whether we have these exclusivistic claims and start asking whether they're true claims. Because that's what Jesus said. In fact, Paul said about Jesus in Colossians, the second chapter, all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are deposited in him. So that without him, you couldn't do physics. You couldn't do math. You couldn't do biology. And on and on and on. And it's a longer story than we have time for here to explain that. But you see, Christ does make these exclusive claims. It's me or it's nothing. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. It make more sense for people to say, well, he's wrong. Now the question is, the next layer is, how do you, if it is the case that Christianity is the only way, how do you prevent intolerance? This is only hypothetical, but I need to point it out to you. Hypothetically, we shouldn't be tolerant toward other faiths if the Lord tells us not to be tolerant toward other faiths. I mean, if it's true that the sovereign, triune God that is revealed in the Bible tells us we should go out and cut people's heads off if they won't believe, I mean, what are we going to do? Say, well, we voted. We don't like that. Well, God said it. Your voting doesn't make any difference. But here's a better answer. The better answer is, and as it so happens, the reason why we're tolerant of other people is because Jesus tells us to be tolerant of other people. Say, but if Jesus is the only way, maybe Christians will start becoming a persecuting force and so forth. I'll say, well, if they do, they aren't acting as Christians. That's all I can tell you. You can't hold it against Christianity when people act contrary to the theory. See, that's not a disproof of Christianity. That's a disproof maybe of the profession of faith of the people that are acting that way. But the issue here in the long run is, can there be multiple distinctive truths? Not rationally, there can't. And if there can't, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to live the life that God tells us to live, which happens to be one of gentleness, after all, and respect toward others, and not telling them that if they don't believe, we're going to kill them. I'm not doing so well on time. Number four. Since the New Testament was written decades after the life of Jesus, how can we know whether they accurately present his life and words, or that they were modified projections of what the writers and church wanted to believe? I wrote down here, the same problem exists for overnight news accounts. The fact that the New Testament documents come decades later doesn't take away or add to the problem of subjectivity in the reports. You realize that? What you read in the newspaper of what happened in New York yesterday is affected by the biases of the writer, and what the editor wanted you to hear, and how he wanted you to hear it, and what order he wanted you to hear it. So you're never going to get away from that in historiography. It's not a matter of time. It's a matter of accuracy. Number five, I can accept the idea of a creator. Why do I need to accept that the only plausible description of this creator is the God of the Bible? Soundbite answer. Because only God can reveal what he's like. I mean, we don't get together and start saying, what's your opinion of God? What's your opinion of God? And let's put these all together. That'll be the God of our common conception. God's not flattered by that. No one's in a position, either in terms of accuracy or in terms of authority, to say what God is like. The reason why you have to accept the Creator God of the Bible is because that's the one who revealed himself. Number six, the Big Bang theory seems to establish our universe as billions of years old. This runs counter to a literal interpretation of Genesis, where each day is 24 hours. Doesn't this support the view that Genesis is really a mythological explanation of origins, should not be taken literally? And I don't have time to talk about what we mean by literal interpretation. But again, the anatomy of the question is, Genesis says this on this interpretation. Big Bang says that. So doesn't that mean we have to adjust Genesis? Well, think about it. There's another alternative. Maybe we should adjust our scientific theories. I mean, that's not ruled out in advance, is it? Somebody says, oh, but science has got such prestige. Well, I'm not terribly old, but I've lived long enough to know what the confirmed results of Big Bang theorizing have been over my lifetime. And they keep changing. Now, if you knew you had a field that kept changing its conclusions, why would you say automatically whatever the fad answer is now has got to be true? It may just be that after they finally refine all this, they'll get closer to what the Bible is saying, which in my view means closer to the truth. Number seven, the problem of pain and evil. How can a good God allow pain and evil? What are the preconditions of intelligibility for this problem? I was once on a radio call-in show where somebody was really upset because I'd spoken of adoring God. They said, how can you adore God? And I said, what's the problem? This person had been in a courtroom and had seen evidence of child abuse, particularly bad child abuse. They said, how could a good God allow that to happen? How can you adore God like that? Now you see how the person has contradicted himself? Maybe you don't. Let me just play this out for you real quickly. I asked him, I said, you're apparently very indignant about that child abuse. You think that's really wrong, don't you? Absolutely. I said, I do too. I think it's horrible. But I can make sense out of saying it's horrible. Since you don't believe in God, I don't see how you can make sense out of saying that's horrible. Because if there is no God, it's just what one animal did to another animal. How can you bring any moral evaluation into the picture at all? You see, the problem of evil, ironically, is not a problem for Christians. It's a problem for non-Christians. It's the problem of how can they call anything evil in their worldview. But then they'll say, yeah, but for you, what do you do with the fact that your loving God allowed this terrible thing to happen? And the answer to that is the answer that was true at the time that God spoke with Adam and Eve in the garden, when he spoke with Job, when he dealt with his own son on the cross, and what Paul says in Romans and so forth. It's the same answer throughout the Bible. God has a morally sufficient reason for what he does. Trust him. Now, what's the alternative to that? Somebody says, well, I'm not going to trust him unless he tells me what his reason is. I'll say, oh, in other words, if God will condescend to no longer be God, that he might be judged by you, once he's passed your test, where you've been the God of God, then you're going to allow him to be God. Is that what you're telling me? This world fit into the pattern that he has planned, that the script is going to make it all work out. But if you don't accept that, then you've got to swallow the consequences of not accepting it. And that is, you have to say, well, child abuse and all these other sorts of things, they're just what molecules in motion do. And number eight, this is the problem of talking about the gospel when there's the perception, real or supposed, on the part of a seeker as to the moral consequences inherent in Christianity. How do you deal with these? And I may not understand this question correctly, but I think what's being asked here is, well, now what if somebody says, but if I were to become a Christian, then I'd have to live my life this way? Or what about what the Christian church has done in history? What do I do with that? Well, remember that we're not defending Christians, much less ourselves, or the Christian church in history. We're defending the Christian worldview. And it may well be that if there's something Christians have done in history, well, we know many things have been done that are wrong. What we want to say is the reason I believe that's wrong is because I'm a Christian. Here's a case where Christians didn't live up to what, you know, the Bible said. And so don't take it out on the Bible. Just say, well, you don't agree with those Christians. We all have embarrassing advocates, after all. Isn't that what C.S. Lewis said? People who defend our point of view but do it in such a terrible way by their lifestyle or their method that it really doesn't do honor to the faith. But the fact is, those moral consequences are not the consequences of Christianity. But more likely, you'll have somebody who says, well, but if I became a Christian, then I'd have to do this. Let's say I'd have to stop living with the man that I'm living with. Now, how do you deal with that? Honestly. I think you need to say it. It's the most compassionate thing you can do. That's right. Because if you're going to take up your cross and follow Jesus, he's going to expect you to make a cut with everything in the past that has been unclean and unholy and impure. And so you have to choose. You can live in sin, the pleasures of sin for a season, and finally answer to God for eternity. Or you can start living eternal life now and cut with these things which are in fact bringing you down. But you see, that's the loving thing to do. The compromise thing to do is to say, well, become a Christian, then we'll work on those things later. Now, I think people need to know, Jesus said this, count the cost ahead of time. I don't want people, after they become Christians, to say, oh, I didn't know what I was getting into. I want them to know up front. And then when they say, yes, I've chosen for Jesus, then I can say, then I'm going to be with you. We'll do it together. Whatever the cost, whatever it hurts, I'll help you through this. But I can't help you compromise between Jesus and your sin. And so I may not have answered all your questions adequately, but I hope I've given you at least a little taste of what you might do when your unbelieving colleagues raise these questions. Let's review real quickly. Not marbles, webs. Deal with the webs, and then press people for the preconditions of intelligibility
look for contradictions in what they believe in their web and arbitrariness, and hold out to them the only option in the postmodern world that maintains objectivity and rationality and moral absolutes is Christianity. Thank you.